Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. What do the girls need? What do the urban, adolescent, African-American girls in our community need to get past the roadblocks and find their successes? To address answers to those questions, the Ohio Department of Mental Health, Mental Health America of Summit County, and researcher Fran Frazier have created a partnership called Rise, Sister Rise, evaluating of African-American girls' experience of trauma and resilience in Ohio's communities. Joining us today to talk about the program and what we know is Fran Frazier. Fran is the lead researcher for Rise, Sister Rise. She has served as a consultant to numerous universities, colleges, professional associations, school districts, and social service agencies across Ohio and the nation. She earned a master's in learning disabilities and behavioral disorders from OSU, and I could say much, much more about her, but without further ado, welcome to the show, Fran.
Welcome, Ann. Thank you.
Tell us about Rise, Sister Rise, and what you're working at to achieve.
Okay, I'd like to give you a little history first.
Great.
I've been working with girls, not just African American girls, but all girls, middle school through high school, for a long time, around relational aggression, and which is, you know, how
girls.
Tell
us what that means to normal.
It really is how girls relate to each other.
Okay.
Primarily in a stereotypical way that we used to think was harmless. A cattiness, you know, telling rumors, stories
gossip
about each
girls,
other,
that kind
gossip,
of thing.
That kind of mm-hmm. thing. But it's much deeper than that now. And so it's exclusionary. It's hurting. It's backbiting. It's what can I do to make my relationship with you worse than ever? Simple things that really aren't simple, like we used to be friends when we were in middle school, but now I'm in high school, I have another group of friends, and you can't be a part of those. And so if a girl in my new group doesn't like you and wants to fight you, then I have issues of loyalty about whether I'm with the old group or the new group. Mm-hmm. And it's creating havoc in schools. And I think the videos that we've seen on YouTube and in media have shown that it's gotten way out of proportion. So schools may call me and say, you know, what can you do? And over the years, one of the things that I've noticed is that whatever the catalyst is, it's not in the school. It's what girls are bringing from home or from their community to the school.
Okay.
And one of the concerns I've had is, what exactly is that? You know, what's going on? And so there are trauma events, divorce, any kind of loss, somebody going to jail, grandfather dying. I know girls who spend weekends in bathtubs with their younger siblings because of drive-by shootings. So that's where they're safe. And so you deal with this on a regular basis. And I think what we know now, there are 201,000 African-American girls in Ohio, and the majority of them live in metropolitan areas. So the traumatic stressors they have are greater than kids who are not living in urban settings. So they bring this to school. Primarily, you look at it as these are just everyday occurrences. So this isn't something I would tell my counselor about or my teacher about. You just live with those things. But they build up. And
then they coalesce, or they're concentrated in the school when everybody brings their issues.
Everybody's bringing their issues. And if you don't have something in place, things happen. You know, one girl told me, I can't wait to come to school some days because there is so much going on at home that I want somebody to bump into me in the hallway.
So she can take it out.
Just so I can punch back. So I got a call from Leslie Brower about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And she said, Fran, are you still working with girls? And I said, you know, I really am. She says, well, we're interested in looking at mental health issues in communities of color. And I was wondering if there was something that you're really finding out about your girls that you'd like to look at further. And I said, you know, there really is. I want to know what's going on in our girls' lives and in their communities that they're bringing to school, because I'm seeing the effects of it in school. And I'd like to know, what are some of those stressors, and why is it that some girls have the same thing but seem to be resilient and can work that through? I would love to look at that. And so that's how our relationship got going.
My guest is Fran Fraser. She's a lead researcher for Rise Sister Rise, evaluating African-American girls' experience of trauma and resilience in Ohio's communities. If you have a question for our guest, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and pop your question or comment on there. Fran, the study is evaluating African-American girls' experience.
It is.
What is the difference? How are you making that distinction when you're looking at these behaviors and asking these questions versus girls in general? Because what you're describing sounds way too much like girls in general.
It is girls in general. But what we haven't had is the voice of Black girls.
Okay.
And that's something that Leslie and I and other ODMH people really talked about. And Leslie said, Fran, are you sure you just want to look at Black girls? And I said, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then Leslie called a number of researchers around the country. Is this the way to go? Because we wanted to make sure we were doing the right thing. And a number of the responses was, well, you know, maybe you should include Latino girls or white girls or Asian girls so that the population is more broad-based. But truthfully, I believe that the voice of Black girls has always been diluted because they tend to just be a small population of a much larger population.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't get the real voice of Black girls. And I think it's real important that their voice is heard in a very substantial way. And so that's why we're just looking at African-American girls in four cities. So it's Akron, Columbus, Dayton, and Lima. And we wanted to look at cities that have a large metropolitan base where there's a large African-American population. But we also wanted to look at a small city that had a large Black population.
Lima.
So that's why we went to Lima.
Okay.
Yes. And probably when all the data is collected and we look at key factors, we'll find out, well, you know, these kinds of things may be happening with other groups of girls. But I would imagine that the cultural implications will be much different. And I
tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think racism has plays a big part in the kind of stressors that play out in an African-American girl's life. Like one of the questions we ask girls in the survey is, do you like being Black? If you don't like being Black, what color would you like to be? What are some things about yourself that you like or don't like? Many Black girls do not like their hair. Having hair, being an African-American, any African-American woman who's listening, she will tell you, hair can make you have a good day or a bad day. And for our girls, if the hair is not right, if you can't get it in a way that's going to make you feel good about yourself, your whole day, excuse the expression, is
mm-hmm.
jacked.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins to impact your self-esteem, how you're going to navigate through the day, what people may say or not say, and it certainly will impact your own communication with someone. So hair is critical. The girls would say, I would prefer to be mixed, because then if I'm mixed, my hair is straighter. I can do more. It's more flexible.
And
I can do more with it.
And the whole point of that is what they're seeing out there because ostensibly if their hair was considered beautiful in the media and that sort of thing, it wouldn't be a problem. But the point is it's not fitting into some template of beauty.
Well, actually,
is that it? Or
let's take me.
It's a hassle.
When I was growing up, I had lots of hair, but it was a lot of hair. And, let the rain come, and my hair would be all over my head. And I was not feeling good about myself. And perhaps if long, flowing, blonde hair was not the standard of beauty, then perhaps yes. Mm-hmm. But I know even for friends of mine who are white, who don't have long, flowing, blonde hair, they have trouble.
Right.
Because the standard of beauty is something totally different. But specifically for women of color, and more specifically for African-American girls, because in addition to hair, I've got skin color issues as well. So if I'm not light, if I'm dark with short, curly hair that tends to be unmanageable, I don't hear anybody telling me that's beautiful. So if I don't dig way deep down inside and pull out information that somebody has already said to me about how wonderful I am, I've got big issues with who I am.
And how many 12-year-old girls have the maturity to do that is the question.
Absolutely.
So what do we do to help them?
Absolutely.
Right. We have to take a break. My guest is Fran Fraser. She is the lead researcher in the Sister Rise Project. We'll continue to talk about that. If you have any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Also joining us coming up, Leslie Brower. She's a project director in the Ohio Department of Mental Health, where she coordinates hospital and community continuity of care. And she is going to tell us about why the Department of Mental Health has gotten involved in this issue. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning. Jacques Pepin's world travels influences cooking. Watch his show, More Fast Food My Way, Saturday afternoons at 2:30 on WOSU-TV. Then be sure to tune in on April 30th when Jacques will be in the WOSU kitchen for Chefs in the City.
Support for 89.7 comes from Kappa, Steve Solomon's off-Broadway one-man comedy titled My Mother's Italian, My Father's Jewish, and I'm in Therapy, starring Ron Tobin, comes to the Lincoln Theater April 1st and 2nd. Details and tickets at kappa.com.
It's 32 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today, and gradually becoming sunny later this afternoon, a high of 40 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 23. Some sunshine for Friday, and a high of 41. Clouds Friday night, and still cold, a low of 25 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about a partnership. It's a research partnership. It's called Rise, Sister Rise, evaluating African-American girls' experience of trauma and resilience in Ohio's communities. The research will come out, and we'll learn a lot more about that probably next summer, sometime in July. But joining us right now is Fran Fraser. She is the lead researcher for Rise, Sister Rise. And again, Fran, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anne.
And also joining us now is Leslie Brower. She's a project director in the Ohio Department of Mental Health, and she's going to help us understand why the Ohio Department of Mental Health got involved in this project and is funding it. Meanwhile, I want to let you know that as an introduction to the project, there's a panel discussion scheduled for next Tuesday, March 29th. It's called When We Were Girls, Telling Our Stories of Trauma and Resiliency. It's at the Lincoln Theater And we will have a link to that so you can learn more about it at your leisure at WOSU.org/allsides. So When We Were Girls, Telling Our Stories of Trauma and Resiliency, next Tuesday, learn more about that. Go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up a little bit later, the moderator for that, Dr. Elaine Richardson, will be joining us as well. So we can talk a little bit more about that then. Leslie and Fran, I was reading something by Dr. Venus Evans Winters. She wrote that in social science and educational research, African-American female adolescents' experience in particular have been left out, whited out, subsumed under white girls' experiences, blacked out, generalized within the black male experience, or simply pathologized. I was wondering if you could explain what that means, because it sounds like it has everything to do with what we're talking about today. Fran?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because there's been this question, why are you just looking at black girls? And earlier I said, because we need to hear their voice. But it's true, there's very little literature out there about black girls. And they have been. I think that there's been a ton of literature on black boys.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually nothing. I mean, when we started doing our lit review for the research, we didn't really find that much to tell us what really is going on with black girls. And I happened to be on a White House call about women, and the Women's Policy Research Institute came up as a source. And so I decided to Google them and found out that they had partnered with the Black Women for Black Girls Giving Circle in New York and had helped to fund a research study of black girls in New York, in the five boroughs. And truthfully, other than that small study, I don't know of anything right now that, other than what we're doing, that begins to look at the issues of black girls. So I think it's real important that we begin, because our girls end up being statistics for everybody else's reason for why funding should happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's the true story. I don't think it's the real story.
Leslie, you are from the Ohio Department of Mental Health. It's funding this project. Tell us why the department got involved in the first place.
Right. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. First of all, this is a terrific show and a great opportunity to talk about, I think, a very significant public health problem, as well as some really wonderful information and resources that are now available that haven't historically been available. The Department of Mental Health mission basically is to establish mental health as the cornerstone of health. I think many of us know that kind of intuitively, that if your mental health isn't good, a lot of other stuff flows from that that's bad, your self-confidence, your way of approaching work and studies and so on. Well, a number of years ago, we learned about this truly groundbreaking study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which has, I can only say it really has what I consider earth-shaking implications for virtually all of the kind of health and social problems that we think of as some of our thorniest problems. And there's sort of good news, bad news story with that. The first is that, the bad news sort of, if you will, is that childhood trauma is far more common than anybody ever dreamed, except people who have been through it. From a public health standpoint, we are really becoming aware of how much.
Just to interrupt you for a second, even people who have been through it grow up thinking, nobody else has gone through what I've gone through.
That's right.
There's a lot of isolation.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And actually, because of some of the psychoneurological impact of serious trauma, sometimes people aren't even aware that what has happened to them is causing them to have things like periods of numbing, of blacking out, of not remembering what has happened to them. And that creates problems in, if you will, in the concept of therapy. Very often people are not believed. Children are very often not believed when they tell stories of what is really happening to them. So, that's a really insightful comment, Anne, because part of our mission really is to make it safe for people to talk about what has happened to them, what's been done to them in some instances, and to develop programs that are helpful and responsive and that come early enough in a person's life that it really can make a difference. It's really a very basic kind of prevention, early intervention concept. So that's part of the good news of it. So first of all, childhood trauma is far more common than anybody really knew from a research standpoint. Second of all, it has very serious and lifelong implications. It doesn't go away, the history, that the childhood trauma history doesn't go away. You can learn to manage your feelings about it. You can adopt behavioral changes that help you feel better, that help you move on in your life, that help you develop better relationships, but it really never goes away. And that's a really important part of our understanding of many, not only behavioral health problems like depression and substance abuse, but what this study, this adverse childhood experiences study, is telling us is that it also has implications for our physical health. And this was a brand new insight from this study. Very serious issues around obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, as well as some things that are big surprises like cancer, liver disease, and so on. And so I think researchers are beginning to understand the roots of that. Why does childhood trauma result in this higher percentage of all of these kinds of diseases? It's pretty much, I think, getting to be accepted that it has to do with the presence, the chronic presence of stress hormones in your body, which then set off this whole chemical reaction that you end up with these diseases of there's really stress-related diseases. It's compounded by things like smoking and substance abuse. But in a way, with somebody who has suffered trauma, those things even, which we blame as lifestyle choices, let's say, those were early attempts to cope with the negative feelings.
The self-medication, that kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly, yeah. So when we became aware of the implications of this study, we knew we had to do something about it from the standpoint of the Department of Mental Health. We had not had portfolio around trauma. That was really kind of new for us. Mm-hmm. Other states in the nation, particularly on the East Coast, had been working on this for quite some time. So we began a childhood trauma task force, and it submitted recommendations that we're now sort of finishing up that report. But basically, as a result of that, we have a big federal grant that's now, unfortunately, it's wrapping up, but it's given us the ability to support programs in child welfare areas. You just had Crystal on here. They have adopted the knowledge about trauma and are now working with their child care workers, child welfare workers, and collaborating with mental health practitioners around how to really help these kids and families who have been through these awful experiences.
There's a lot of talk about trauma, and you just mentioned Crystal Ward Allen from the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio talking about foster parenting and those kind of issues and the trauma that just going through something like that is. Trauma is a much larger concept than we used to think of it. It's not physical abuse necessarily, or it's not only that.
Yeah, anybody can experience trauma, and frankly, in life, most of us have a trauma at some point in our lives. But the reason that we chose to focus really on childhood trauma is that it sets a template for the rest of life. And what we've learned, even from magnetic resonance imaging studies of kids who have been seriously traumatized, it changes your brain structure. Some of that can be reversed, but particularly in kids who have had long-term multiple kinds of exposures, you end up with some very severe damage that plays out in the school setting, at home, in relationships, in behavior and substances, things like that we've talked about.
So did you find the same thing that Fran did, that there just wasn't any basic research done on adolescent African-American females?
Absolutely. It was really kind of a shock. It intersects with another one of our priorities, which is reducing disparities. We know that there's all kinds of disparities, both in health status. I think Fran kind of alluded to that. African-Americans, by and large, die much earlier than other populations. They have much worse school or higher school dropout levels. Almost any measure you look at, African-Americans are, you know, in the worst situation.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that some of that, that racism itself is a chronic long-term trauma, it sets up these psychoneurological circuits around chronic stress. So we suspect that that's part of what's going on in that. But then if you then add to that tendency to be concentrated in urban areas where there's other stresses, exposure to all kinds of external community traumas like gunshots and the losses. Most people who live in the urban area have many losses, of significant losses in their lives, very often to violence.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to address this disparity. So this was actually a perfect convergence of Fran's work and our interest both in childhood trauma and the issue of reducing disparities.
You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you would like to join the conversation. Dr. LaDonna in Cleveland, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're a nonprofit organization here in Cleveland called Goddesses Blessing Goddesses Org, providing family peer coaching and life coaches for young people. And we're finding that mother plays a significant role, and she is key to the family. So how would we connect with you all and work collectively as agencies to provide more of a need in a larger arena?
Fran?
I'm really glad you asked that question. It would be great if we could get your information. We have a telephone number that you could leave your information with, or even our website. So our telephone number, can I give that now, Ann?
Sure. Well, we can post the telephone
okay,
number on our
great.
Website at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll also post a link to the website as well. But go ahead and give the phone number now. Sure.
Sure. 614-259-RISE.
Okay.
R-I-S-E. And the other thing is, too, Ann mentioned that we are having an event on the 29th.
Yes.
If you would check WOSU's website, that'll give you more information. But I think that would be a great introduction to our work and possibly a good opportunity to begin to make our connection.
Thank you.
And let me jump in here, too,
sure.
and say that for the most part, the interventions that are helpful to people are not rocket science. They're not expensive. You know, sometimes there are people who really need additional, really specialty services, but referrals are helpful for that. But in general, the message is make it safe for people to talk about what they've been through. Don't ask what is wrong with you. Ask what has happened to you. Tell me about what's happened to you in your life. And being a willing listener, if you will, a witness to what has happened to people and how they're trying to make sense of that in their life. You know, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, this is an amazing statistic that this was 17,000 people in this study. It's a sort of an amazing,
yeah.
huge study. All they did is they asked these 10 questions that are on the back of one of your documents there, and we can post this information too, as part of a comprehensive health assessment. And asking that question, in the following year, doctor's office visits dropped by a third. No other intervention, no referrals for counseling, no treatment programs. So this is across a huge group of people. doctor's office visits dropped by a third. And it has to do, we believe, with this secrecy, that people are holding these secrets, not feeling they can tell them, not feeling they can talk about them, and that they won't be believed. And opening the air, opening those things up to the air and making sure people feel that they are believed is just an incredibly good place to start.
Well, I want to ask about that. And thank you, Dr. LaDonna from Cleveland. We appreciate your call. The Women's Fund of Central Ohio just put out, they had a program at
the
Columbus
Girl.
Metropolitan. Yeah, the One Girl. And one of the really primary revelation from all of the work they did, and they asked a lot of the same questions, but arguably did not focus on African-American girls, is that girls want mentors, but they don't want adult mentors. They want peers. They want somebody who is close enough to them and what their daily reality is to talk to them and help lead them. That adults aren't it's just not doing the trick, and it's not what they want. They don't want to listen to an adult. They want to listen to somebody maybe a year or two older. And in high school, that's like, you know, a lot. Fran Frazier, are you getting the same sort of feedback from girls that you're talking to?
You know, I think it's both and.
Okay.
At least that's what our experience is in the African American community and what we're hearing from girls. Because we may ask girls, who's the biggest influence in your life right now? And they'll say, my mother. Who will you talk to when you need to do some sharing? My friend.
Right.
So I do think it's both and. If you've got the right kind of connection with your grandmother or an aunt or extended family member, you might go to the adult. But very often,
adult's more like a role model, though, in a way. There's a difference between a role model and a mentor, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. In our focus group in Akron, we had about 15 girls. And we asked one of the girls who would you go to if you've got something on your mind? And she said, my cousin, who was two girls over, because she knows how to listen, and she doesn't judge me, and she's good at advice. And what I do know is that girls will go to other girls if those girls have the countenance and the skill of listening and being trusted. Because part of that kind of deep sharing is you want to make sure she's not going to go and tell your business when she decides that she doesn't like you anymore. So those are some stipulations then.
Right.
But normally, if a girl is a good listener, You'll definitely go to her.
Al and Gahanna, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is for Dr. Frazier. What can parents of middle school children do to help alleviate the situation? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Al. Fran?
I think two things. If there is a dad in the house or a custodial dad, a dad who's in a girl's life. Truthfully, I think for many girls, having that solid male figure is paramount to having a girl feel safe enough to talk about what's going on. If she has a good relationship with her dad, it's just the best. I also think that parents can do a lot when they're on the same side with each other in having that conversation.
The unified front.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, because it's real easy to play one parent against the other. But when both parents are unified on, especially around bullying, because a lot of girls will not talk about that in front of their parents because they don't know how to. And then parents, of course, don't know exactly what to do about it. My niece, for instance, she has a daughter, and one day Dana went to school, and none of her friends were talking to her. No reason, just went to school. They had all decided they weren't talking to Dana that day. And it made Dana it was very traumatic.
Yeah.
Really, she came home crying, not because nobody was talking to her, so nobody could tell her, you know, because she was asking, why aren't you talking to me today? We always go to class together. How come I'm by myself? My niece called up all the moms of all of the friends and asked for a conference with their daughters and said, we're going to sit here and talk this out until we get somewhere. I think what it does is it says to the daughter, you're not in this by yourself. Me and your dad are with you. And we're going to take some control over the situation so that you don't feel so vulnerable of having to fix it yourself. So I think that's what parents can do. They can be a lot more vocal and supportive and not just say, well, this is something that girls do. Because truthfully, it's not.
We have to take another break. We are talking about research. And it's called Rise, Sister Rise, Evaluating African-American Girls' Experience of Trauma and Resiliency in Ohio's Communities. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we return, we'll get to those emails as well. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how pizza, pasta, and olive oil came to America. Food writer John Mariani talks about his new book, How Italian Food Conquered the World. Mariani is also the author of the Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink, and he writes about food for Esquire magazine. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. You can do that by visiting WOSU.org/email to sign up.
Support for 89.7 comes from Horizon Science and Noble Academies, providing college prep curriculum focusing on science and math. Information about Horizon and Noble Academies college acceptance rates is at horizoncolumbus.org.
It's 33 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today with some sunshine peeking through later this afternoon and a high of 40 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 23 degrees. Some sunshine for Friday and a high of 41. Mostly cloudy Friday night, a low of 25 degrees. And clouds as we look ahead to Saturday, a high of 43. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about Research Rise, Sister Rise Research Project, how to help urban adolescent African-American girls experience their world in a positive way and in a way that will not traumatize them later in life. So if you have a question or comment for us, we welcome it. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. With us, Fran Frazier. She's the principal researcher for Rise, Sister Rise, and also Leslie Browell from the Ohio Department of Mental Health. And joining us now is Dr. Elaine Richardson. She's a professor at Ohio State University and is going to be the moderator for that panel discussion that we talked about for next Tuesday. Welcome to the show, Elaine.
Thank you.
Leslie?
Yeah, I just wanted to underscore something that Fran was talking about in the response to your previous caller. The research really shows two things in terms of parent role or family member role. The first is to promote a secure attachment, a secure emotional attachment, and we're really talking about those first months and years of life. it's not all over if it didn't happen, but it creates a lot of problems if it doesn't happen. So the first thing, it's not middle school, but it's in the very early months of a baby's life to promote a secure emotional attachment. May not be the mother or the father. It may be an auntie. It may be a neighbor who gets involved. But that is critical for that child's future. The second thing is, and this really would be more relevant for middle school, is to pay attention to and respond to the young person's emotional state. I think particularly with teens, we tend to get caught up in the issues, the stuff, the, you know, the music, the whatever it is, and that's fine, but always to be thinking about what is this child telling me about their emotional state and how can I validate that, make sure they know I care about their emotional state. Those are two things the research shows are very important.
And very tricky.
Tricky.
Yes.
Very, very tricky. Elaine Richardson, professor of literacy studies at Ohio State University. She's the author of several books on cultural literacy and is a motivational speaker and educational consultant. She will be moderating the upcoming Rise, Sister Rise panel discussion, When We Were Girls, Telling Our Stories of Trauma and Resiliency. Her latest book is PGD to PhD, Po Girl on Dope to PhD, a memoir about her experiences in the street life and her journey to success. So welcome again, Elaine, to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Moderating a panel like this, it sounds like you ought to be on the panel.
Well, I am a part of the panel as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the moderator, but I'm also there to prod people to talk about traumas that they've had in their life and how they what resiliency strategies we use as Black women to overcome traumatic experiences.
So tell us a little bit about your story and what helped you overcome your obstacles.
Definitely. A lot of what Fran and Leslie said, I just wanted to say amen to so many things that I've heard. Especially about knowing who you are and feeling beautiful on the inside. I think there are a lot of messages that young girls get outside of the home and also in the home, because we live in society where we're getting messages about ourselves from so many different things.
True.
I remember being a young girl playing with my brother, and we would be looking at magazines, and he would show me who all the pretty girls were in the magazines. None of them looked like me. And he would always talk about how their hair was, and if someone came on television, if a woman came on television, if she didn't have long flowing hair and light skin, she would not get pretty from my brother.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned early on that I didn't look like the people who were pretty, even though I know my brother loved me.
Mm-hmm.
So there are just societal things that are always gnawing at us. And we have to have constant input from loved ones and from people who are investing in our spirits and in our lives that we are beautiful, that we are valuable. Now, I had that. I had an intact home. My mom and my dad, I grew up with my parents. We went to church. You know, we had spiritual input in the whole thing. But the societal images are so strong that if you have a trauma in your life, it can very much adversely affect you.
It's
all the time.
It's just kind of waiting there.
You're always questioning, am I worthwhile? Am I beautiful? What's wrong with me? Especially, I think, as a young Black woman, I think people are always interacting with you based on what you look like, how you talk, where you're from. Myself, I grew up in a very impoverished neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio. I was not, you know, interacted with as one of the pretty girls.
Mm-hmm.
I was what you would call a regular Black girl. I noticed how teachers responded better to light-skinned girls, to light-skinned boys. How even your friends would choose you based on what you look like, what you wore.
How old were you when, if you can think back, when that first
occurred to you? You know, now that I look back on it, because I've had to reflect on it constantly to write my book,
mm-hmm.
I can remember when I was little, you know, people interacting with girls who didn't look like me, and how, you know, people would say, oh, your hair is so pretty. So kids are smart. As you're learning language, you're picking up everything about, oh, that's pretty. I don't look like that. Or, you know, nobody's ever said this about me. So, you know, I had a very traumatic early experience. I was raped at the age of 13. I have never gotten over that rape. I never dealt with it directly because at that time, I don't think my parents knew that I needed counseling. And it's not a common practice in African-American communities to get counseling for rape or for other traumas that you have. You know, you just go to church, you pray, you cry, but you keep going. Mm-hmm. And this is some of the things that Fran is talking about, how people experience traumas all the time when you are in, you know, a not insulated community, like when you're in a racialized poverty situation, like I grew up in. People are trying to put bread on the table, so they may not even have the resources to get the counseling or the support
and
that
they
girls
had their
need.
Own traumas, and nobody offered counseling to them.
See, mm-hmm. That's true. But my mother, one of the callers, the Dr. LaDonna that called in and said how the mother is important. My mother never gave up on me. She was there for me. She ran behind me. She picked me up. She tried to get me a big sister. She was always at the school. My mother was Jamaican. She only went to the sixth grade. Her parents died. Her father died when she was very young, and she had to start working at the age of 13. But she wanted a lot from me. You know, I was in America. She wanted these opportunities that she never had, but she wanted them for me. Mm-hmm. And all these different things kept happening to me, and she couldn't understand it, but she just kept pulling me by the hand. Whatever trash can I jumped in, she tried to get me out of it. When I got raped and I was pregnant, my mother worked, you know, like a dog to get me an abortion. I could not see myself having a child. I remember my mother begging my mother, "Mom, I don't want to have a baby. I don't want to have a baby. I don't want to have a baby."
And this was from the rape.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I never even told my mother that I was raped. I didn't know how to tell my mother that I was raped because I felt like it was my fault that I was raped. But anyway, that set me up psychologically to make a lot of I hate to say choices, because one of the things that Leslie pointed out is that once you are traumatized, you get into behaviors that you think you need to be into to make yourself feel better. Mm-hmm. You don't understand why you're choosing to hang out with a certain crowd. You don't understand why you accept certain behaviors from people. You don't understand that at 13 and 14. So I just became attracted to a lifestyle of further trauma, of further sexual exploitation, of drug use. And eventually I became a prostitute. And eventually I became a drug addict. And my life was so far down the line that I didn't know how to get out of it. Eventually, one day at a time, I was exposed to a program called Project Second Chance. And it was run by a social work professor at Cleveland State University, Andrew Edwards. And it was four girls who had been sexually exploited. I saw a flyer one day. I was getting out of jail at the Justice Center in Cleveland, Ohio. And I wrote down the number. I was desperate. I wrote down the number, and I called the number, and I went to visit Dr. Edwards periodically. But I was still on drugs, and at that time I'd had a baby by my oldest daughter's father, who was my pimp. And I didn't feel like I could leave him because I had this baby by him. Mm-hmm. And I had gone through all these things with him, and I just kept holding on to him. And plus, I was holding on to my drugs as well. So I was trapped in this cycle, and I didn't follow through with a lot of the things that I was supposed to be doing for myself that I had learned from being in Project Second Chance. And so it took me just going to the bottom of my life before I just got desperate enough to start doing things for my child. I got pregnant again while I was out in the street life. Mm-hmm. And I got so desperate that I just came to a point where I wanted to do everything that Dr. Edwards told me about. You know, like, you know, you have to stay in AA. I used to laugh at people who went to AA. But one of the things that they told me that I had never heard before, even though they said it to me before, but that I did not hear, was don't take the first pill. Don't take the first drink. If you don't take the first one, you won't have to worry about the last one. So eventually I just started listening and being desperate enough to follow what other people were telling me and just taking one step at a time, going back to school, getting taking advantage of different support services, child care services, talking to other women who had gone through what I went through.
A lot of people that have gone through what you went through spend their life trying to help other people, mm-hmm. and it's really interesting the way you've channeled that into literature is probably just as fulfilling and just as helpful.
Definitely, definitely.
Because it's a voice.
Most of my research is tied into struggles that I had. So my main area of research is applied linguistics. So we talk about the ways that people use language and how language is the center of how you know, how you learn, and you're getting all these messages about yourself and the world through language.
We had a caller, Steve, who wanted to know what influence rap music has had on teen African American girls. Do you have a feeling about that?
I think it has a lot of influence on girls.
Now, there's some good music out there, but
right.
we're talking about the bad
stuff.
We're talking about
as a part of the general public culture,
right.
that is pop culture, that is harmful to women, but especially to young black women, because we're fed so many of the same images of scantily clad women in, very sexist, presented very, like almost like prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the major image that young women are fed in the media of black women. So that is definitely a harmful image. And the program that I work with at Sherwood Middle School, we watch videos and talk about them, to talk about the what is the message that you're getting from this song, from these images. I think girls have to have people in their lives talking to them about the messages that they're getting from the music. I think it's very harmful. And I think that we have to work together as a community to give our girls strategies to think against what they're being bombarded with.
We have an email from Angel. She says, this is a wonderful topic. Could you touch on how relations between black teen boys affect girls? Fran?
I was just going to say that I think the music and what boys are looking for and how girls respond are really all connected, because so many of our girls see themselves only as body parts. So they accentuate what body part is.
Attracts.
Yes. Is attracting boys, and it's all connected with the music. So I will accentuate my breasts, or I'll accentuate my thighs or my butt, but I never see myself as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I see myself as body parts, because that's what's going to get attention. And so I think part of this is, what kind of messages out of this information that we get on girls, what kind of messages then can we say to black boys about how to look at girls differently?
We have run out of time, and I'm sorry to say that. Thank you so much, Fran Frazier, for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much.
Fran is the lead researcher for Rise, Sister, Rise. It's a research project about urban adolescent African-American girls and their experience in the world. There's going to be a panel discussion about that next Tuesday from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Lincoln Theater. It's free and open to the public. Fran, what age is appropriate for that?
Actually, the forum is for system workers,
okay.
clinicians, social workers,
so it's for
professionals.
Adults.
And the event in the evening with Terry Williams
okay.
is definitely for girls.
Okay. Check our website for that. I also want to say thank you very much to Dr. Elaine Richardson, Professor of Literacy Studies at OSU. Thanks for sharing your story, Elaine.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for everything. And also Leslie Brower. She's at the Ohio Department of Mental Health. Leslie, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.